Welcome to World Bridges Live Wire for May 29th, 2005. Today we are webcasting our very first featured interview show, and for this occasion, I'm very pleased to have as my guest Jerry Trowbridge, a.k.a. PBC Liberal. Aside from his very thought-provoking podcast, which can be found at pbcliberal.users.blogmatrix.com, he's a veteran radio broadcaster, having spent many years behind the mic with both public radio and commercial radio. He is also one of the founders and idea guys behind Flying Pig Ranch, a group of companies dedicated to the integration of computers and broadcasting. In addition, he is quite a radio historian who I hope can put some of today's revolutionary media developments, like podcasting and vlogging, into an historical context for us. Jerry, thanks very much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Was that introduction accurate?
Yes, it was. We really hoped that radio would adopt more computers sooner, and for reasons other than just firing people wholesale.
Now, you have spent much of your life involved with producing audio or video in some way. I wonder if you can take us back to your very first experiences as a listener. I'm assuming that was before podcasting existed. What are some of your earliest memories as a radio listener?
Back a very, very long time ago, we're talking like 1955, my parents bought me a radio and a phonograph because I took ill when I was three. And so I would sit in bed and I'd listen to radio, and I decided, I think at that point, that that was what I wanted to do. And I also, because I was ill, I didn't have a lot of, I'm an only child, two only children, and I didn't have a lot of peers at that time of my age. So I spent my life living really in a world of audio and in a world of adults, and I think that's why I wound up being so interested in it.
What were some of the shows you remember listening to?
Yeah, the strange thing is that I remember listening to a fair amount of religious radio, and I was fascinated by the different denominations and how they approached things. And that may be one of the reasons that I've kind of become a fan of Outchurched and a lot of these religious broadcasts that are not quite religious. And I think it also may be now in later life why I've become interested in Joseph Campbell. And of course, that kind of came too from the way Hollywood developed scripts. And I went through a whole process of reading about character arcs and that kind of stuff, and that kind of takes you back to Joseph Campbell.
It's kind of interesting that a lot of the early radio webcasts were religious in nature. I didn't realize that, and it's also interesting to see how popular they are now in the world of podcasting.
One of the reasons that that may be, and this is really kind of more Ryan King's idea than mine, but churches have an awful lot of material that is audio. For the sick and the shut-ins, they've been doing it a long time. And of course, the other thing is that evangelicals believe that they have a duty to go out and preach the gospel. In fact, there's a story that's told, and I don't know if it's true or not, but in the earliest days of satellite, before we had a lot of downlinks, but we had uplinks, one of the original satellite providers was approached by a church, and they said, you know, we want to buy some time on this satellite link. And the provider said, well, that's fine, and we'll be happy to sell you some. But we ought to tell you there aren't going to be any listeners here on Earth because there aren't any downlinks yet. And the church said, that's okay, that's not who we want to talk to.
Huh. Build it and they will come.
Yes.
How did you get involved with radio production?
Well, I got involved in, when I was 15 and a half, I decided that I wanted a job in radio. So I went to all the stations in Southern California, and I'd, you know, get on a bus and spend 2 and 3 hours going all over Southern California, and I'd walk in and say, I want a job. And they'd look at me kind of, you know, like, yeah, I'm sure you do. But they'd usually also give me a tour of the broadcasting facility, and finally, in 1967, at a little station in Long Beach that was all of 330 watts, and I'm talking effective radiated power at 190 watts transmitter output, a station called KNAC that had been KLFM, they gave me a job, and I just liked it, and I started.
Was your first job behind the mic?
No, no. Oh, no. They were much too smart for that. They, first job was the typical first job you get in a radio at a very small station, which is you run automation equipment. You are a warm body. This was back in the days that you had to have a somebody with an FCC license. Oh, that's the other thing I should say is you needed a license back in those days from the Federal Communications Commission, and I had a third-class radio telephone permit with a broadcast endorsement, which you get for answering a bunch of questions. I went down to downtown Los Angeles and took the test. So they had the warm body in me, and I could sit there and answer the phone and play the stuff. And then KNAC, of course, went on to be quite something. It went on to be the one of the premier underground stations. But I left there, and actually I think I may have switched jobs with a guy named Jim Ladd, who became a real big deal in underground radio, has a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame now. And he went downstairs in the International Tower building to the 12th floor where KNAC was. And I went upstairs, which was a country radio station, and I was a producer there. And as it turned out, that was one of the best jobs that I had in radio because it was top 40 country. And I worked with some really, really brilliant people that could just sit behind the mic and come up with the most amazing stuff off the top of their head. And so I did that, and I did, at that point I got involved in telephony because in those days you would pick up remote broadcasts from over telephone lines that were equalized. And this was before FM was big. Our 1,000-watt AM station really made the money, but we made all the money on the FM on Sunday when we did remote pickups from churches, generally black churches in Compton and Watts, and they put me in charge of seeing to it that all these remotes actually made it on the air as a producer, and I really enjoyed that. And I didn't wind up actually on the air until several years later.
Was that the time when remotes started playing a role in radio?
No, remotes really came along very, very early. In fact, we call them remotes because they would say by remote control broadcast, and the idea was that that you would be remotely controlling the broadcast station, which you really weren't doing. I mean, basically, there was just a pod on the board that was hooked to a phone line, and there was a remote amplifier. Remotes really came about very, very early in broadcasting. In fact, the station that I worked for, KFOX in Long Beach, had a history in the market and was one of the first stations that did remotes, and it and KGER, which was another station in the market, used to fight over who would carry the municipal band broadcasts, which would come from the band shell. And that was when they first started realizing that they couldn't just go out and hook a mic on the other end of a telephone line. They need to build amplifiers and do fancy stuff like that differentiate good quality audio from stuff that comes in over a telephone line. And we're talking the early 20s here.
Mm. Well, you know, almost everyone alive today has grown up with radio in one form and another, and very few of us see it as anything revolutionary. But I believe you've dug up some old archival material from the days of early radio, and you've got some clips that may put it in a historical context for us. And I think you start with the cutting-edge hybrid technology of radio telegraphs.
Yes, which was developed by either Marconi or Tesla around the turn of the last century, depending upon what camp you're in. You know, as usual, there are multiple people that develop these things, and we can fight forever over who really was the first. Marconi probably got the most notoriety. He utilized something called spark gap transmitters. He was an Italian who worked mostly in the UK, and of course Tesla was a Serb, but he worked mostly in the US. There are four stations that all claim to be the first, and I'm in the KQW camp. In 1909 in San Francisco, there was a radio telegraph station there, KQW. It became the first station to transmit voice because of a guy named Doc Harold. What he did is he used carbon microphones and spark gap transmitters, but the mics kept burning out because the whole power of the transmitter actually passed through the mic. So he found a better way. He developed a water-cooled microphone, but the trouble was the transmission method was really flawed. In 1916, Frank Conrad, he was assistant chief engineer of Westinghouse, he built an experimental radio station in his Pittsburgh garage, and he used a better method. his experiments sound a little like podcasters do today. His wife thought he was crazy to mess around with it, and the couple was interviewed about it several years later.
That is a hobby I carried out at home. In fact, it's one of those things where you finally got deeper and deeper into it. I got to, people would call me up at night and ask me to transmit. They once said they had some friends, wanted to listen to something coming out of the air. So I would transmit either talk or phonograph music or something like that. And I finally got to take care of that. I sort of arranged to send a program twice a week, every Wednesday and Saturday night. And that really started, was the first regular broadcasting. And, of course, at that time, I actually had no idea what it was going to end up into. Maybe if I had an idea what to end up into, I'd stop.
But I think he thought it would be quite an industry. Father was so mad at me when I said it wouldn't last. It grew from a few wires wrapped around a piece of pipe. I couldn't believe it. You looked at that thing and it talked back to you.
The reason for the start of KDK was due to the fact that some of the department stores in Pittsburgh began to advertise radio sets, which would receive signals that came from my laboratory. Well, some of our company officials, Mr. H.B. Davis, he saw those, and he thought, my, here, that looks like that's going to be a big commercial. So he said, now, we better do this out here in a good scale. This little one-horse thing you've got down to your house isn't enough. So we had a station there, licensed as KDK, that was put up for the purpose of transmitting from East Pittsburgh to some of our other factories. Successor did that, so we converted that into a broadcasting station.
This is KDKA of the Westinghouse Electric and Manufacturing Company in East Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
It's really difficult to get people to think outside the box. Very few people in podcasting see this medium as a unique one, with the special strengths that can be exploited. I guess that's normal.
I have a chicken and egg question about Frank Conrad. He kind of plays around in his garage and creates a radio transmitter, and his neighbors listen. How is it that they had anything to listen with?
That is a good question. There were a bunch of experimenters that were messing around with receivers in the home. But, of course, there were a great number of receivers that were out there to receive code transmission. And you could receive a voice transmission done this way or a code transmission on the same receivers. But there weren't many. And this really kind of starts the division between the people who were the ham radio operators and the people who are the commercial broadcasters whose main interest is seeing to it that programs are produced that are of interest to people in their parlor. And, you know, we have a kind of the same thing today, and it's what I call the ham radio operator school of podcasting. Some of the podcasts you listen to are people that talk about what kind of equipment they have, and that's really a ham operator kind of thing to do, and it's of real interest to those of us that are doing their own podcasts, because you can listen to somebody and say, oh, that's the so-and-so USB microphone, or this is an Audio Technica 2020A. But we're going to get past this fairly soon, and we're going to get to the point that we're going to have listeners, and they're not going to really care too much about what the compression algorithms are or what the microphones we're using are, or anything like that.
Every medium eventually becomes content-driven.
It does. It does. And unless, of course, you're trying to get it into something else. I mean, Westinghouse originally wanted to see the radio telephone as a way to replace the telephone, the wired telephone, the same way the radio telegraph extended the telegraph. Yeah, how can we, you know, we do this now, how can we find a way to make this fit an existing business model? But it took a while before the folks at Westinghouse realized that people could listen in on a conversation, and that wasn't a bug, it was a feature. And they stopped trying to make the radio telephone a secure way to achieve a point-to-point communication, and then they turned around and concentrated on other ways to make money. And it wasn't long before they found two ways. One of them was getting radio performers to praise sponsors' products. A good way to do this is get to name the performers after the product, like the Gold Dust Twins. The other way was to take the profits from selling radios and use that to pay the performer for the broadcast. May Singy Breen, for instance, was a ukulele player and a singer who was an early radio performer. She got paid by Gimbel's department store out of the profits from selling radio receivers.
They asked us to come down one Saturday morning and play for Gimbel Brothers, because Gimbel Brothers were having a big sale of radios. Then they suddenly realized there was no program on the air before 12 o'clock. So WAF had to put a special show on, and all the artists got $5 a piece from Gimbel's to go on with the show so they could demonstrate their radios in the store. I know that Mac and Me was on, Jones and Hare on, Goldie and Dusty. Goldie and Dusty had the Gold Dust soap powder, and the Happiness Boys had the Happiness Candy. But anybody who didn't have a commercial got $5 for going on that program. It didn't make any difference to us whether we got paid or not, because we weren't used to it anyway.
Next big leap was the rise of the networks. Stations realized they could save money. They could form networks and produce one program in New York or Chicago, where the vaudeville stars were, use special, expensive, high-quality phone lines and link all the stations together and broadcast the same program. NBC began on November 15, 1926. Now, the biggest stations in every market became the network affiliates, but there were more stations than there were networks. Today in terrestrial radio, we're all pretty much big corporations, because now we let companies own multiple stations. The way the government exerted control over broadcast stations and over what was actually broadcast, though corporations, of course, deny the extent to which they're controlled, was because there's a limited number of them, and the government said because of this limitation, well, we need to be very careful about who actually gets the licenses. So from the earliest days, there were ownership limits. There still actually are some, but they're not really very limiting anymore. Just take a look at Clear Channel, for instance. So you had a lot of owners. They broke down among various types. Some were newspapers, though the government tried to get rid of newspaper cross-ownership, and they had some success in that until they just gave up. Some were car dealers. In L.A., Earl C. Anthony was the Packard dealer. He owned the biggest station, KFI. Don Lee, the Cadillac dealer, he owned KHJ. A whole bunch of stations throughout California, in fact. And these guys were usually the network affiliates because they had the money to increase the power back in the days that they could, and of course those were the stations the network wanted. NBC could be heard over KFI over all of Southern California. But, you know, then there was, too, the little guy who owned the unaffiliated radio station, and he's kind of the guy that reminds me of podcasters today, usually in a smaller market. And he needed to have this weird mix of talents to build and run this place. He had to be a pioneer, he had to be a musician, an announcer, an engineer. They're the talents we see today in the people that say, you know, I want to do a podcast, because we're all pretty much one-man bands. But most of these guys are lost to time. Hal Nichols, for instance, he put K-Fox Long Beach, where I worked, on the air. But if you Google him today, you won't find a single reference to it. Here was a guy that most of Long Beach knew for 30 years because he was on the air on his own station and because others on the station talked about him often.
Hello, my lovely swell people, and the cheeriest of greetings to you on this Friday, February 21st, 1947. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, Hal Nichols. Happy birthday to you. Ladies and gentlemen, tomorrow is the birthday of the owner and operator of KFOX, Mr. Hal Nichols. And in honor of this gala occasion, our program today in its entirety is being dedicated to him.
That's Jean Cowan. She did a 15-minute sponsored show on KFOX. She was your girlfriend. She sang and she pitched products and she gave tips and hints. And it was program-based, kind of like podcasts are today. And if we could modernize it somehow, because, you know, it's really dated, it's ready for RSS. Nichols was a violinist, a band leader. He ran dance studios in Denver. He teamed up with his brother and a guy with money from World War I named Warner. And they came to Long Beach and built the station. The other two guys died, and the station became Hal's. She's sucking up to her boss, of course, but she tells the story pretty well.
In the early and roaring 20s, we find this enterprising young man of ours, his name in light, at the head of his own place called the Nichols Academy of Dancing,
a famous rendezvous for the twinkling feet of that era, when all of a sudden, like, a newfangled fad called radio loomed into the limelight. Never one to remain unaware of the possibilities of a new idea, Hal took to broadcasting like a duck takes to water, and soon his music was being heard on a receiver in a nearby amusement park, until such time that people began having sets installed in their homes. It wasn't long after that Hal was convinced that this new toy was a worthwhile thing, that radio was here to stay, and he lost no time in getting in on the ground floor. His license for broadcasting was the 9th one issued in the United States, which really puts him in the Big Ten, or Big Nine to be exact. His call letters were KDQZ in Denver before he came to Long Beach to establish this city's first radio station. KFON it was called then, with the studios in the Markwell building, which later became the Jurgens Trust building, until Hal purchased his own, the modern, efficient plant that still houses KFOX here at 220 East Anaheim. Hal is remembered by many for such programs as the Hal Nichols School Kids, Al and Molly, Burning Questions with Hal as an inquiring reporter, Hal Nichols and his Bad Pennies, and the current and best of them all, Melodies and Memories program, from the Memory Room, heard nightly at 6:30. Despite his successes and achievements, Hal is the same genial, friendly person he's always been. Kind, generous, and like all truly great people, humble.
And now, of course, he's forgotten. That was 1947. By 1952, Hal was dead. Radio, at least program-based radio, was dying. A guy named Egmont Sonderling bought the station, turned it all country, got rid of the 15-minute, half-hour, and hour programs, and he went to music radio playing records, very much like what we have today. And that's where I'm really going with my view on podcasting, which is a lot of people believe we can just put radio the way most people today have grown up with it, which is music-based records, and just put it on podcasting. And now, I think we really need to think outside the box.
Well, why do you think program-based radio died?
Because television killed it. Because program-based radio required you to tune in at a particular time and listen to a broadcast. And if you were going to do that, and if you were in a particular place, you could watch television. The television got put in the center of the parlor, and the radio got put in the corner of the parlor. And radio, like the great Pat Weaver that I talked about on one of my podcasts on Monitor, realized that radio kind of has to fill in the void. You know, radio has to kind of be there all the time so that you can turn it on and join it and listen to it for a while and then leave it, because anything really important is something that you'll go and sit down and turn the lights off and watch on television. And, you know, that's kind of happening with HD today and with home entertainment. I think the next thing that's going to die is going to be the theaters, and we're all going to be sitting in our living rooms and watching the important programs, and the rest of the stuff is all just going to come and fill in our lives. You know, it's going to just fill in slots when we're commuting or when we're, which is why I like the whole time-shifting arrangement of MP3s, and why I really like the fact that you can talk in a very complex way to people. You can use real big words, and if they don't understand it, they can either say the hell with this and hit the forward button, or they can hit the back button and listen to it again. And in radio, you can't do that. I mean, the way you write an obituary in radio is you tell them three times who's dead. You know, the old thing is you tell them you're going to tell them, and you tell them, and then you tell them you told them.
So what are the dangers to podcasting? How can it avoid the perils of radio?
Well, we got to think outside the box, and I sure wish that I was smart enough to come up with the answer for this and say, you know, we need to go do this. But what we really need to do is rethink this and say, what is there about this medium that enables us to do, well, for instance, one of the things that really excited me very early on, and I'm starting to hear people do this, a lot of people are talking about the way we can bookmark MP3s. One of the things you can do in this, since there's no now, if you're doing podcasting, is that you can billboard the beginning of a show, and you can say, if it's a long-form show, and you can say, on today's show, we're going to do A, and we're going to do B, and we're going to do C, and A is going to be right now, and B is going to be at 2 minutes 15 seconds into the program, and C is going to be at 7 minutes 25 seconds. And at the time you go into B, you can billboard C. You can pitch people on, you know, because one of the things about radio is always keep them listening and keep them listening as long as you can. So you say, if you're not interested in B, well, you're going to love C. And we're going to get to C at 7 minutes 25 seconds into the podcast, so just skip forward. And, of course, when we find some good way to tag things, we can have another button on the MP3 player that just takes you to the next bookmark.
I want to backtrack a little bit and ask you how you first became aware of podcasting and what inspired you to start producing your own.
I'd had MP3 players for a long time, and we went through the hurricane here last year, and which pretty much wiped out the building that we were in. And it was a mixed blessing for us, because, of course, it was a terrible time to go through. But one of the things that it happens is it's kind of, a hurricane is kind of like a brush fire, is that it comes through your life and it cleans out a lot of the old stuff that you thought you really needed, but as it turned out, you really didn't need. I had a bunch of, I'm radio nut, so I had a whole bunch of old-time radio systems, stuff that was really valuable that I lost, but I realized, you know, I don't listen to radio anymore. So what do I need a 1922 radio for, considering I don't even listen to the medium? So I had the MP3 player, and I really never set it up after the hurricane. And then I got an AudioBox SMT2600 because I wanted to go back and set it up and listen to MP3s. And I don't know how I heard about podcasting and RSS, but, you know, I'm on the web a lot, and I heard about it. And I went and I found the Perfect Path guy. I heard Lloyd Davis's podcast, and he had just come from having coffee with Adam Curry, who at that time didn't have his DSL feed at his house set up, so he was down at Starbucks. So Davis, and I think that's his name, I'm doing this off the top of my head, but he went down and found him at Starbucks, and then came back and did this podcast. And it was January 1st of this year, and we had celebrated New Year's, and I'd had a lot of wine, and it was about 3 o'clock in the morning, and I was taking the garbage out listening to this guy, and it was just, you know, Florida, it was beautiful Florida weather, and he was talking about how bad the weather was there, and it took me back to something I'd read about station KHJ in Los Angeles in their early days, just sticking a mic out the window in a freak thunderstorm in Los Angeles and broadcasting it, and some person in Florida listened to it and sent them a letter and praised how much that they'd enjoyed listening to this Los Angeles thunderstorm. And I thought, history is repeating itself here. So here I am in Florida listening to somebody across the pond talk about the weather, and this is going to be the start of a real change in media.
It's funny how the conversation always seems to begin with weather, though.
Doesn't it, though?
You had mentioned in one of your podcasts that so many of the podcasts that you really like are very niche, and their potential audience is so small that commercialization isn't a real possibility for them. Yet, on the other hand, we see commercialization efforts with things like Podshow and Odeo. How do you think podcasting can keep the niche podcast spirit alive while it inevitably becomes commercialized in some way?
Well, one thing it can do is go to a subscription model. And I know that that's a very bitter pill for a lot of people that don't want to pay. But take a look at what we're paying for now. Take a look at, I don't watch commercial television anymore. I watch HBO. I watch Showtime. And I pay for the content. And when you pay for content, the dollars go an awful lot farther than when you have this whole big infrastructure that takes you as a listener or viewer and sells you to somebody else and basically pitches you to somebody else on the basis of who you are. The other thing is that there are an awful lot of areas, and especially as we are still early adopters and opinion leaders that are listening to these things. I mean, one of the things I love about doing podcasts, although I don't do them very often, is the people, and I know other people are talking about this too, is the people that are listening to you. I mean, when I did this thing on the commercialization, I was absolutely amazed at some of the people that put links to me on their blogs, and I had no idea. And this thing just kind of goes from person to person to person, and we're a very, very, very small community. Well, but we're a small community of opinion leaders, and in some areas, like where IT Conversations is going, we may just be powerful enough in being opinion leaders that we're worth money to people. And I'm talking generally, you know. But, you know, you consider the people that are out there, like Weiner and Curry and all these people that are Scoble, that are evangelists for things. Getting their ears is important, and there may be people willing to pay for that.
I guess the question then becomes, how is the subscription system organized? Who's at the top of the chain? Or is it the kind of thing that could be done independently so that you become sort of your broadcasting station in your garage, but people can pay to subscribe?
I don't know. You know, I don't know where this is going to go from here.
How do you think this will affect traditional media?
Well, I think traditional media is pretty much in the toilet right now. I think that it was the thing, one of the things that I pointed out. We have one of the problems, and my partner is really the one who's advocating this, and he thinks this is really in some ways a terrible development that media has become so fractionalized, because when you have 2,000 and 3,000 and 4,000 choices, there's not enough money anymore to produce quality material. More than that, we are becoming a society in which we are grouping together with like-minded people. I mean, I moved to the community that I'm in because it's liberal, because I am in a blue county, and I'm not living around people that, you know, wax philosophical, that wax political here. I'm not living around people that like George Bush. One of the things that I like most about the property I'm on is one of the first things out of my neighbor's mouth when he came over to introduce himself is that, I don't know what you think about the president, but, and he launched in a rant, and I thought, I'm home. Well, we have that same kind of thing happening in media, and that's what my partner's view on this is that we're all preaching to the choir, and there's no common ground, and we're not talking anymore. I mean, in the early 1950s, when Edward R. Murrow did the thing on Joseph McCarthy and the thing on Milo Radulovich, the country could be outraged. Well, the only way we could be outraged is because we were all sitting watching the same three networks at night.
Do you share his concerns?
Yeah, I do. But we've also gotten to the point that I don't trust, if we still had the three networks, I don't trust the three networks. One of the things that, I mean, even Ted Turner has gotten on this view. When you have Time Warner being investigated by the Security and Exchange Commission because of the AOL merger, doesn't that have a chilling effect on what they broadcast? The thing I like about this is that as we get more and more and more voices, we get more voices that may be free to tell the truth. But one of the big concerns that I'm coming to, and I've been kicking this around as a subject of another podcast, is we need to be sure that what we are saying is accurate, because as less and less and less people listen to the traditional broadcast media that used to care about accuracy, you know, it's the old, pardon my French, but it's the old Paddy Chayefsky line from Network, we'll tell you any shit you want to hear. And it's kind of the Fox News process here, in which you pick the lie you like. And one of the things you see from things like Inside the Actor's Studio, I can't remember the guy's name who does that, but his research is absolutely impeccable. And every once in a while, he will be interviewing a star, and he'll say, well, you know, you said so-and-so, or you believe so-and-so, and the star will interrupt him and say, well, no, I never said that. But what happens is, when incorrect information becomes reported in the media, it gains a life of its own. And people pick up this information from other media, and they rebroadcast and rebroadcast, and there's no way to ever get it back. And that's one of the things I'm very concerned about, is that, you know, maybe I'm just too old to be doing this, but back in the old days, we really cared about what we said on the air, because we knew it could gain a life of its own, and there was no way to take it back once you said it. And I'm concerned about podcasting for that reason. And maybe, you know, we're just going to get to this caveat emptor view of the world, in which you believe everything you hear is a lie until proven otherwise. But that may be a serious problem if we all have got to get on the same page, find common ground, and save this world. Because
I wonder if there can be a system of checks and balances, though. I mean, bloggers have certainly played a role in keeping the major media outlets honest, and they've been the first to catch them when they stray from objective truth, if there is such a thing. And I'm wondering if either word of mouth or reputation creates certain podcasts the new content creation revolution, people gives them certain credibility by just word of mouth.
I sure hope so, and that is a very good thing. And of course, the other thing that on new media is that back in the old days, we did care about what we said on the air, and today apparently mainstream media doesn't care too much about what it says on the air, or Dan Rather would still be working at CBS.
Right, and I wonder how it's going to play out with politics. Being here in New Hampshire, I'm certainly gearing up for the 2008 primary and hoping to provide, you know, one of the great things about the New Hampshire primary is you get this personal contact with candidates that you just don't get otherwise. And if the new media can kind of bring that level of connection and make people connect to politics or news or whatever, I'm hoping that can be a positive development.
I hope so, too. And the other thing is, we are where we are, and we're... I don't like what I'm seeing on the mainstream media, and I read blogs, I get almost all of my my news from the internet, and I try to gauge it and to watch it very closely. And that's, you know, to get back to the original question that started this whole thing, that is one of the reasons that I think mainstream media is going to fall apart, because nobody's going to watch it anymore, or, you know, not many people.
What, if any, thoughts do you have about this kind of live webcasting? To be honest, I'm surprised that there isn't more of this out there. Since I saw Real Player 1.0, I thought, oh my God, everyone's going to have their own global radio station next year. But here I am in 2005, and I haven't seen that much of people doing this kind of thing.
I think you may see more when we develop better ways to get wireless devices connected. Because the thing that I've really liked about RSS syndication and downloading stuff at night and having it automatically show up on your device is that I can take it with me, and I don't need to be wired in order to hear it at the time I hear it. I have this AudioVox phone that is with AT&T now, Singular, and the its GPRS. And when they pitched our office manager on it, they told her that it was unlimited connectivity. But when we got into it and looked at it, the same package, when it's on a card that plugs into a laptop, is unlimited connectivity because you have to basically offer that. But the same service, when it's on the AudioVox SMT, is 50 megabytes a month. And I think the reason for that is that they looked at it, they saw what was happening with iTunes and with Napster to go, and they said, oh my God, we're gonna have kids downloading hundreds of megabytes of songs and then video on these portable devices, and it's gonna swamp the network. When we get a better way, when we get more bandwidth to portable devices, when we get Wi-Fi portable devices, if the old line telephone companies can stop bribing politicians long enough to let us get some municipal Wi-Fi in places, I think we're going to start seeing live more. But I think we're living in a time-shifted world. And what I like about what you're doing, and the reason I wanted to be involved in it, is it's a great way to do this kind of ad hoc Gilmore gang type thing where a bunch of us could all get together and sit and talk. But I think most people are going to listen to it time-shifted, and I think they always will.
Yeah, so far that's been the case. I'm hoping eventually to have enough of an audience so that the next time I invite you back, people can Skype in or chat in and ask some questions. Do you have any parting advice for all these new homegrown content creators, technical advice or otherwise?
That's a good question that I hadn't considered. I was listening to podcast 411 when I was on the treadmill, and I think the thing that he's come up with is really good, is that content is king, that audio quality is queen, and I would go toward shorter form than longer form because people can build. Oh, yeah. I have some real good advice. Go to a website called Real Reviews and find a production done by TM, which was Tom Merriman's jingle and radio production company. In the 1980s. And it is called, well, of course, now it's lost me, Tomorrow Radio. This production was done in 1980. And it basically says what radio is becoming. All these ideas that we're all kicking around were all pre-digested by TM. And to some, I would really love to do a piece on them and find them and ask them the question, did you realize when you were doing this production that you basically, in the cracks, were announcing the end of radio? That in imagining this, you imagined that radio basically would go into, would become something else. I mean, in Tomorrow Radio, the formats last 15 minutes, and they change. They have Kitty Radio, which is Disney. They talk about just about the only thing that they didn't hit right on the money was that the nuclear cloud is over Pittsburgh. Everything else, KHJ going country. That is really the paradigm, at least to me, to where media, this electronic media is going. And if you go listen to it with some thought as to the fact that it's 25 years old at this point, I think, you know, that's the holy grail. I think all your questions will be answered.
Okay. And on the note that content is king and audio quality is queen, and keep it short, we will wrap things up. I want to thank Jerry very much for being our first featured interview guest, and remind everyone out there to stay tuned to worldbridges.com/livewire for new schedule information. You can also subscribe to the Wire newsletter, and we will email you any schedule updates. Jerry, thanks very much.
It's been my pleasure.